Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines, with 4,000 flights to 250 cities in some 40 countries around the world every day. It's easy to book your next flight at AA.com. American Airlines knows why you fly. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. Today we're traveling to Tibet, and I have with me Michael Cohn, who contributes to the Lonely Planet Guide to Tibet, several guidebooks to that region, Central Asia. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Now, Tibet is this mysterious Buddhist kingdom that is quite misunderstood by a lot of Americans dreaming about traveling to Central Asia. What do you find the magic of Tibet? Why is that your specialty?
I went to Tibet when I was 19 the first time, and I just fell in love with the place. Everything about it, from the high mountains of the Himalayas to this kind of mystical Buddhist culture. And the Tibetan people are just incredibly friendly and welcoming and always smiling. It's just, it's very otherworldly and really nothing like anywhere else I've ever been.
Would you say it's purely Buddhist? Is that the dominant religion?
Yes. Tibetan Buddhism developed from the 8th century, and it's been going strong. You know, there's a lot of changes now in religion in Tibet these days, but Tibetan Buddhism is still the dominant religion.
Well, let's get right into that, because that's the big question for a lot of people considering traveling to Tibet is, will you experience Tibetan culture, or will you experience imported Chinese culture? The country was open to tourists back in the 1980s, and since then, China has liberated the country from its traditional culture, hasn't it?
Yeah, there are many changes happening in Tibet, and it accelerates all the time with the Han population moving up there. So Tibetan culture has eroded a lot over the last 50 years.
If you went 20 years ago, you'd find it more traditionally Tibetan, and today it's diluted by lots of Chinese settlers.
It depends where. Yeah, in Lhasa, people just tend to wear street clothes now in Lhasa. In other parts of Tibet, it's still quite culturally intact. There are actually areas of other parts of China, like in Gansu province or Sichuan, where there are Tibetan communities still living that dress in more traditional fashion and have kind of a tighter rein on the religion, or even parts of India where the Tibetan communities still live. But in Lhasa, Lhasa is changing very fast. It's becoming kind of a more of a Chinese city.
So that's almost ironic that if you're looking for a traditional Tibetan culture, you're less likely to find it in Lhasa, in the capital.
Yeah, you need to get further away from the big cities now, like Shigatse or these other places that maybe around there would have been more traditional culture. But now you have to move further into the valleys and up into these mountain communities where the influences are not so strong.
So if you're looking for the traditional Tibetan culture, what's your best tip?
I think that you would need to get on a bus and get away from Lhasa. There are some regions that are still extremely traditional. You could go out to Mount Kailash, which is a three-day pilgrimage around the holy mountain, Mount Kailash. And to get there requires a good week to get out there and then to do it and then come back. So it's like a good 3 weeks. Hmm. And then there are other places you could go in Gansu and in Xiaha. But basically, you kind of need to read up on Tibet, and just, you can't expect to go straight to Lhasa and expect to find this magical kingdom with the Buddhist god king sitting up in the Potala, because actually he's not there anymore, and things have changed so much, and it's really turning into sort of a Chinese city with the big straight boulevards and everything. You wouldn't find traditional culture so much in Lhasa as you would have.
Now, when you were a student, you established a political group called the Free Tibet Campaign, right?
Mm-hmm. Down in Santa Barbara, yeah.
And today, it must anger you to go back and see how this traditional culture has been squashed by the superpower of the region.
It is a tragedy, definitely. It's kind of heartbreaking as well. I don't think China's ever going to let go of it, and this is just something that some people are starting to accept and understand it, and other people are looking for ways to fight against this Chinese influence.
Is it the Chinese agenda to go into those valleys you were talking about and go into those regions and ultimately replace all of Tibetan culture with Chinese culture?
I don't think the Chinese care so much about eradicating Tibetan culture. They know that tourists go there. They know that tourism's a big business. And they understand, keeping traditional culture alive is going to allow tourists to come back. So the culture will never die out. But when you go to a monastery and you think that this is such an amazing experience and these Tibetans have freedom of religion and you hear that, you know, there's no freedom of religion in China and you think, well, maybe there is because these Tibetan monasteries are intact. But actually in those monasteries, there are Chinese agents that are basically spying on the monks and making sure that there's no dissent in there. So what the tourist sees is not always the reality of the situation.
Hmm. Well, that's important for a visitor to understand. I know in the beginning of your book, the Dalai Lama, he sounded very warm and sweet and, of course, nonviolent and not even judgmental against the Chinese. Has he given up on nationhood now? What's his take on the current situation?
The Dalai Lama has basically given up on the idea of independence. He wants him and some of his closest people want to go into dialogue with China, and China refuses. They consider him a separatist. His ultimate goal, I think, now is autonomy within China, Tibetan self-rule within China. And I think that's sort of his more realistic goal. He switched maybe 15 to 20 years ago from independence to autonomy. But the Chinese still wouldn't listen to this because they wouldn't believe it. For them, this is still a separatist issue.
But his nonviolence and his spirituality sure comes through in the letter he wrote in your book.
It does. The Buddhist way of life, what you read is the Buddhist mentality and the nonviolence, and the Dalai Lama has always preached nonviolence.
Now, if you're traveling all the way to that region and you want to experience Tibetan culture, I keep hearing you can experience it outside of Tibet, actually surprisingly well. When I was in Nepal, I was impressed by the strength of the Tibetan culture in what seemed like refugee camps. What's the status of those these days?
There are Tibetan refugee camps all over India and parts of Nepal. There are Tibetan communities that have lived there for centuries. For example, in Mustang in Nepal is basically a Tibetan community. And you can also experience similar Tibetan Buddhism in Ladakh, which is a northern portion of India. They don't speak Tibetan, but basically they follow Tibetan religion. And Bhutan is similar in that sense. In Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama has his government in exile, you can experience Tibetan culture freely, and it's a very welcoming place for tourism as well.
I'm speaking with Michael Cohn, and Michael writes the Lonely Planet Guide to Tibet. Michael, if you're looking for Tibetan culture, you need to understand Buddhism, I would think. The pilgrimage is a big deal in Buddhist culture, and reincarnation is important. Give us a quick thumbnail on what to look for as travelers when we're in Buddhist countries, whether it's Tibet or Ladakh or parts of India that are Buddhist.
For the Buddhist, the important thing is to gain karma for the next lifetime. This lifetime is really kind of meaningless. So future lifetimes are important. And if you can gain karma in this lifetime by doing good deeds, by going on pilgrimages, by praying, you can gain karma, and the next life you'll be better off. So in Tibet, you'll frequently see people going on pilgrimage, and it's quite amazing, frankly. You'll see them walking on highways. Sometimes their pilgrimage might take 2 years, and they might prostrate themselves the entire way to Lhasa, which is basically like sliding on the ground forward, standing up and praying again, sliding down on the ground, and they'll walk like this for months on end. When they get to Lhasa, they'll do a circuit, a kora around the Potala Palace, and they'll prostrate themselves for hours on end in front of the Potala Palace. And this is all to gain merit for the next lifetime.
So gaining karma is a big part of your sightseeing, actually. You'll see prayer wheels, you'll see all the prayer flags and processions. You're likely to see this even today as you have in past generations?
Yes. Yeah, people haven't lost their faith. I mean, that's the one amazing thing about Tibetans is despite this occupation by China, they haven't lost their faith in Buddhism or the Dalai Lama at all. So you would still see people going on pilgrimages and turning prayer wheels and things like this, just as you would in other parts, as we mentioned, in India or other parts of China.
So, Michael, what do you think when you look at a procession of people who are dragging their bodies and throwing them down and doing all of this suffering for their faith? How is that as a tourist? Do you feel like a voyeur? Do you feel comfortable with that?
It's a good question. I admire it immensely. You know, this is something that I couldn't do myself. And I admire their steadfastness and their faith, because you've seen in other cultures how the beliefs have been eroded. In the Soviet Union, for example, 70 years of atheism kind of disrupted religion. But in Tibet, that hasn't happened. People still have not lost the faith at all. For me, it's wonderful to experience that and to see that, because you know in our own culture, people have sort of lost the faith in many ways.
And the power of that faith in the face of giant superpower and aggressive China, to me, it almost reminds me of the power of Christian faith in the face of the Roman Empire in ancient times. How is mm-hmm. materialism a part of the Buddhist situation? Is materialism a big deal? Because don't Buddhists, by definition, want to be non-materialistic? And
the modern
push is for materialism.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that has kind of affected Lhasa. So in Lhasa, where you get cell phones and computers and cameras, and sure, there are some Tibetans that have gone that way. There is some effect by the intruding culture and materialism, and that's something that's probably can't be avoided.
Are there any tips that you would give non-Buddhist visitors so they're thoughtful and not stepping on the culture?
Well, Tibetans are very forgiving, actually. So you can commit a lot of faux pas, and they'll understand that you're a foreigner and you didn't know, and they'll give you some advice of their own about how to act a certain way in a monastery or in a temple.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, basically, you wouldn't want to do anything to accelerate the problems there, like giving lots of money or candy to children on the street who wouldn't know anything about hygiene, for example.
So common sense in the first world meets developing world sort
sure.
of approach.
Sure.
Let's talk practicalities just for a minute. I'm speaking with Michael Cohn, who writes The Lonely Planet Guide to Tibet. You've got high altitude, that's a concern, visas, language barrier. Talk a little bit about that, please.
The altitude is something that affects everyone, obviously. If you're coming down from sea level, if you're traveling from anywhere in China or India, and you get up to these extreme altitudes of Lhasa, which is over 10,000 feet, you do feel lightheaded for a couple of days. And that goes away, but that will come back if you are planning to hike up in the mountains and there are some passes that hit 5,000 feet, or if you go up to the base camp at Mount Everest, there are pills that you can take to counter that effect.
Does your shampoo explode when you get it off the plane?
Yeah, you open up your water bottles and everything is all soaked because, everything has exploded.
Is that right? So what is the practical tip? Do you put it in a Ziploc baggie?
Yeah, or you could reduce half the size of... whatever you have, cut it in half, so there's still some empty space there. Or, of course, in Lhasa, if you didn't bring toothpaste at all, you could just buy it there.
Now, just as far as nitty gritty goes, do you need a visa as an American traveling in Tibet?
You need a Chinese visa to go to Tibet. If you're coming from the Tibetan side, this is a lot easier. If you're coming from Beijing or Shanghai, the easiest way to do it, or the traditional way of doing it for most tourists, is to go to the city of Chengdu, which is in central China, and catch a flight. I think there are flights every couple of days. Now they have this train line as well going to Lhasa. Going both ways from Nepal or China, you need a permit to go to Tibet. Coming from China, it's a little bit easier because when you buy your airplane ticket, they basically put you onto a tour group of other people that have already bought plane tickets. So you are on this tour group with people that you don't even know. And then once you get into Tibet, you're free to do whatever you want. Now, coming from Nepal, it gets a little more tricky because you have to also exit with the same people that are on your permit.
Well, that complicates things.
And if you want to change that, if you want to separate from your group, then it involves a lot of paperwork and it's basically a big hassle. So it's much easier, practicality-wise, to come in from China. Hmm. They're talking about, they've been trying to change this permit situation with Nepal. That might be changing now, but, as of the last couple of years, it's been difficult.
Is there actually public transportation connections on some highway that goes from Kathmandu to Lhasa?
From Kathmandu to Lhasa, basically, there are tour groups that will go up there, but there isn't a bus that will go from okay. Kathmandu to Lhasa.
Got an email from Elizabeth in Sacramento, California, and she says she's been leery about traveling to Tibet, especially with the new railroad, because she says, I don't want to contribute to turning it into a cultural theme park. Do you know of any volunteer projects that are really helping the locals and the community? So that's a good sentiment. She wants to experience Tibet, but she doesn't want to aggravate the cultural theme park business that's going on. Well, what's your response to that, Michael?
Basically, you want to avoid giving money to the Chinese government, which is supporting the regime there. You want to put money in the pockets of ordinary Tibetans, which means staying in hotels that are run by Tibetans. Sometimes you don't know because it might look like a Tibetan staff and management, but really the owner is Chinese, so that gets a little tricky. But the idea is to put money in the pockets of ordinary Tibetans as much as you can.
So how do you do that on your travels?
You do a little bit of investigation. You find out if the tour operator that's running the trip is run by Chinese or run by Tibetans. And if you're just doing local stuff, like if you want to go eat at a restaurant, then you would hopefully choose a Tibetan restaurant rather than a Chinese restaurant. There are huge numbers of Han Chinese that go to Lhasa to capitalize on the tourist market. There are vast numbers of restaurants and camping stores, and most of these are owned by Chinese entrepreneurs. So it can be a little bit difficult to find Tibetan-run businesses, but if you can, it's better to give your business and your money to them.
I know China still kind of claims to be a communist country, but clearly they're going down the capitalist road. Does it feel communist or does it feel capitalist when you're in Tibet?
Capitalism all the way.
What's the deal? Are they doing communism anymore?
Well, it's a centralized government. There's, you know, just one party. But apart from that, China's economy is super capitalist driven. So
right.
It's glorious to get rich phrase that the Chinese like to promote. So it's a, you know, it's a communist government and there's no dissent there. But
so it's glorious to get rich in the new China.
Yeah. People are welcome to open up businesses and shops, and entrepreneurship is tremendous there.
And Tibetans also, although not as many as Chinese, but you can find small businesses run by Tibetans.
Yeah, but the problem is that Tibetans really lack the resources to open their own businesses. So This is where they're kind of falling behind. And this is one reason why people are a little bit disappointed in Lhasa, because sure, they want to find Tibetan-run hotels and restaurants, but it is difficult to find them because the Tibetans lack the money and the skills to really get ahead of the Chinese, which are at the moment dominating the markets in Lhasa.
Well, and Chinese are atheists, and their new creed is it's glorious to get rich, it sounds like, whereas the Tibetans would still be the more gentle and non-materialist idealistic Buddhist. Is that correct?
It's not so black and white. I mean, In Lhasa, you could very easily meet friendly Chinese people that are welcoming and very helpful. Maybe they, you know, they keep their Buddhist faith, but it's just a matter of sheer numbers. They come in huge waves. They get maybe tax breaks to go move from their home village in mainland China and move up to Tibet. So for them, this is sort of, you know, what they've come for is just to make money, where the Tibetans are a little bit of a daze because they're not familiar with modern business practices and they don't have the money to start up a business themselves. So for them, it's just difficult to get ahead.
Right. Kevin in New York emailed us, and he'll be traveling to Tibet next fall. And Kevin is taking a digital camera with rechargeable batteries. And he asks, is electricity available to recharge the batteries? And what kind of adapter do you need?
You can easily bring any kind of electronic devices you want. The last time I went, I came equipped with a digital camera and laptop computer. I don't remember the exact type of, you might need a plug to plug into the wall. But that's in the book somewhere, whatever the Chinese use. I think it's the two-prong one that we use.
All right.
So you might not need the plug, but good idea to check up on what they use. Definitely electricity is widely available in all the cities
in
Tibet.
Michael, it seems like there would be so many communications stumblers and cultural little misunderstandings, even in gestures. Do people have some quirky gestures that throw travelers a curve?
When you're asking for directions and you say, where's the Potala Palace? Someone will basically pucker their lips at you like they want to kiss you. And basically they point with their lips in the direction of the Potala Palace. And that is their way of pointing. They point with their lips. And the other one, the more famous one, is the sticking out the tongue as a greeting, which is not so common these days among young people, but older Tibetans will still greet you with a tongue sticking out of their mouth.
A little bit of adjustment when you get home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to go home and start sticking your tongue out at people when you greet folks.
Nice to see you. Stick out your tongue. Michael Cohn, thank you so much for an insight into a fascinating corner of this planet, Tibet.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks very much.
Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines. With their new Advantage Award booking tool, it's easier than ever to book to over 800 Advantage Award destinations online at AA.com. American Airlines knows why you fly.